Welcome to Chamber Talk. My name is Andrew Gregson, and today I have a very special guest today, retired Senator Dick Ackerman. Thank you very much for coming on today,
Thank
Dick.
You've
done many things in your life, being state senate, being a mayor of the city, being on the council, being on dozens and dozens of different committees and boards and things like that. But one of the most important things to me today is not only you're a fellow Rotarian, but you're also a past president of the chamber. You were a past president in 78, was it, I believe?
Somewhere around there.
I know that, you know, some of the things you've done have been extremely impressive, and that was how you started off your career. So do you mind sharing a little bit about how you first joined the chamber? What made you first become a member?
Okay, well, I had a law practice in Fullerton. I joined existing practice in Fullerton, and I did mainly business law. So all my clients were business people. A lot of them were in Fullerton. A lot of them were involved in the chamber. And I think somebody said, why don't you get involved in the chamber? And I said, I will. So I did it. They had a very active people there. I think I indicated at the time a lot of very large companies in Fullerton, Hunt Wesson, Beckman, Hughes Aircraft, Kimberly Clark is the other one. I knew it would come back to me. So we had a lot of big business, had a very medium-sized, small business, but they were all very active. So I joined the board, good bunch of people. They were very active. They had retreats. I think one of the big things, they had a retreat in Lake Tahoe because one of the members had a couple of condos up there. So we went up there for retreats.
That's nice.
But they were very active in local politics and very active in working with the city. And, you know, if they had issues with the city, they would bring it up with them. So I got involved in the chamber, and I just... I think the opportunity came to run for office, so I ran for president one time, and I was elected. And it was a great time, very active group, and very important in the local community.
And then what made you, or what inspired you to go from a member to be on the board to then become president? What got you that step? What made you?
Probably some friends suggested it. I probably wouldn't have thought of it myself. But I wanted to be more active in the decision-making process. I could say the chamber was... very active, and I think I can't tell how many members. I'm guessing I'd say 600 or 700 members.
About right if I look at the records. Yeah,
but they had a lot of members, and they were very active, and they did stuff. And I like to be involved with people that are coming up with solutions, trying to make Fullerton a better place to live and do business in. And I really like the fact they also had good relationships with all the colleges. They had Fullerton College here, Cal State Fullerton. I think I'm not sure when Hope University came. But they had a lot of institutional things, plus all the business, so it really had a lot of things going for them.
And then what inspired you then? Sat at work, doing your attorney stuff, working in the chamber, working in the community, and then suddenly you thought, oh, you know, I'll run for city council. What happened there?
Well, at that point in time, our opinion was that the council was sort of anti-business, and they had a big debate on the sign ordinance. They wanted to be much more restrictive. And signage is very important to businesses even now. So we decided we're going to run some people for city council. And we formed a PAC, which is very unusual back in the mid-70s.
Wow.
PACs weren't popular back then. So we ran a couple of people, got two of them elected. We got ready for the next election cycle, and they were hurting for a candidate. So they said, why don't you run? And I really hadn't thought of it. And I said, okay, I'll try it. So I did it. My campaign committee was mainly a lot of people from the chamber. So we ran a campaign. I got elected. I was the number one vote getter, and I was able to get elected a couple times after that. But I decided it's nice wanting to influence the decision makers. It's also nice to cast a vote. So I said, well, I'm going to give it a shot, and I ran and I got elected.
So then, if you don't mind sharing, Dick, because this is very important to me. After being so involved in the community on the side of the chamber and then going on to the council, how do you see the chamber in its operational in the business world when you sat on the council chair?
I don't know if I mentioned it. Before I got there, the city was actually subsidizing the chamber, I think $20,000 or $25,000 a year. And when I got on the city council, I decided to eliminate that, which got a lot of people upset. But I thought it was better for the chamber to be independent, so we didn't have to. I wanted to hear their opinion. I didn't want to feel that they owed us anything. So we did that, and I think we were able to develop a very good business climate in Fullerton. In fact, at one point, I think we recall we got written up in the register as being Blood Alley, because we had four or five of the major discount stores like Fedco, and before it was Costco. We had, I think, five of them along here, because we had a very good, we still have a good location off of 91 Freeway and the 5, plus having Beckman and Hughes and Hunt Wesson and Kimberly Clark. We had a very, very large and active business community. So I think it was very important to establish a good business record. And I think we set, we raised our sales tax revenue. About the only thing a city can control revenue-wise is sales tax. The rest of it, you're all dependent on county and state taxes. So we were able to increase our sales tax a lot during the time I was on the council, along with the other council people's help, because they all saw it was an income stream. You need money if you want to do something in the city. So we created a good business climate, and it paid off.
Now, I'm glad you just touched on that point, because I think it's something that a lot of people don't realize is, you know, yes, we all pay taxes, but very little of that sales tax actually goes to the city, doesn't it? There's a very small amount, right?
Yes, like one cent. When it used to be 6 cents, we got one penny out of each. I'm not sure what it is now, but it's a small part. The rest of it, we really can't control. You're dependent on how much money you get. You get a portion of the property tax. The rest of it all comes from the state and other forms of taxes. The big portion of it is sales tax, but you only get a small portion of that.
And knowing this, like understanding that, you know, because it's so easy to just think, oh, the city gets all my taxes, when really, like you said, it's like 1%. And obviously you still have a budget of running the city, because it's like a big service center, isn't it, a city? It gives services out everywhere. What types of challenges do you face on city council to make this happen, especially if people are like, no, I'm not putting up my taxes? What happens?
Well, I think one thing we did was set priorities. You know, the biggest portion of the city budget is police and fire. And that kind of protection is important to everybody. One of the things that's being debated now is a lot of cities are cutting back on police, which I think is not good. They generally don't cut back on fire, although their fire budgets have been cut back, and that's why you see a lot of cities consolidating or going with the county to try and save money. But I think public safety is the most important thing. But you have to fund all that stuff, or to help fund it, you need a big business climate. And the main reason I got involved in the chamber and in the city and even the state was my business background. If you don't have a good business climate locally or statewide or nationally, you're not going to have any income. You know, people, you have to have jobs. The jobs come from the businesses. And I get a kick when people start criticizing the rich people or the businesses. If you don't have rich people in the businesses, you're not going to have any jobs. And you need those people to encourage them to invest in businesses, because that's where everybody gets their job. And that's where I got clients, was out of businesses. So business is very important in the big picture, and sometimes some of our colleagues don't understand that.
That's good. I'm glad you mentioned all that information there, because I feel a lot of us, we don't know. You know, it's one of those things is, I remember when I first came on board here, there was a lot of talk about the roads and how bad they are in Fullerton and so on and forth. So, however, the city's challenge is it doesn't have the money to fix all that stuff. And so when they proposed some time ago about putting up taxes, I believe it was a hard, you weren't there then, of course. Well, you were here, but you weren't in that job, right? It was your responsibility. So it's sort of like knuckled. And I feel that over time, a lot of that is probably because everybody wasn't well informed as to do that.
Yeah, one of the problems that Fullerton had, even when I was here, is an old city. It's been around for a long time. And old cities have old roads, old water mains. I remember the discussion about water. Water's still a problem in Fullerton. You can't replace all of them. It just costs too much. And so generally, you just sort of wait till something breaks, and then you fix it. But the roads have become, I think, a little worse than they were now. And I think the council, in addition to public safety, transportation obviously is a very important one. If people I hear more complaints of friends of mine that have to go through Fullerton. If the roads are too bad, they're not going to go to the businesses. So you've got to have a good business climate. You have to have an ability for people to get to the businesses without getting their car wrecked. And you want to also have police and fire protection, so if something goes wrong, you're going to get some attention.
Now, you know, a lot of this comes from, you know, when you try and fix things, a lot of things come from experience. If you were to, you know, quickly sum it up, what type of maybe advice or experience would you share with any city that has these situations on how to maybe overcome these challenges?
I think you got to prioritize things to begin with, and a lot of cities don't. They want to try and do everything, and you can't do everything. There's just not enough money. And then you have to have, I think, law enforcement is very important. I think a lot of the homeless problem we've had is that we haven't enforced laws that we've had quick enough. And sometimes it gets to a thing where you go over past the tipping point. We may have gone past the tipping point in homeless in California because we've let it exist for too long. You know, some of the law changes, you know, people get arrested now and they don't even go to jail. They get booked in and they get put back right on the street. So part of that is state law. Part of it's local enforcement. Generally, Orange County has been pretty good on enforcing laws. So I think we have less of a problem both in homeless and crime than in L.A. County.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it is controlled by the city. You know, mm-hmm. you have to make priorities. Are you going to put your money in things like that, or are you going to put your money in some pie-in-the-sky thing or some more things that might feel good, but they don't protect your citizens?
Now, do you feel, because the homeless topic is a huge, yeah. It is, woof, it's over there. Everybody I speak to in work, obviously that's one of their top things. And there's no like magic thing. Personally, I think it's not just a local thing. It's a global thing, yeah. Really. What types of things do you think you may be looking at if you were still in the Senate to maybe push to help these things? You said laws. I mean, is that the answer? Is it more to do with really looking at the problem and seeing how we can help house the homeless? Or is that the what are your thoughts?
Yeah, there's no silver bullet. But one of the things, we used to have mental hospitals in California, and they were eliminated, I think, in the 80s.
Mm.
And probably a third to a half of the homeless people have some kind of mental problem.
Mm.
And you can't put them in jail because the cops, they don't know how to treat those people.
Sure.
And they probably need to be in hospitals.
Right.
At least for a period of time. But now you can't do that because of all the laws saying you can't do it. The other thing is housing costs. It costs much more to build a house in California than it does in any other state.
Right.
Part of that's attributable to a nice place to live, but part of it's all the government regulation.
Right.
I forget what the cost was. If you were going to build a new house in Fullerton, I think the amount that goes to fees alone is like 50 or 60 grand, probably more than that now, just before you put a piece of 2x4 up.
Yeah, I think it's about that for the ADUs right now.
So there's things that can be done, but I think the homeless, I think you need to do something with the mentally ill. We have to crack down on the drug issue. You know, in San Francisco, they're still giving people needles, and I think somebody in some other areas, you can't give them needles. You can't encourage that. There's a good a good example of how to cure homeless in San Antonio, Texas, called the Haven for Hope. They had a big problem in the city because they got a very tourist-type city. It's right on the river. So they created one area, and it was actually done through the chamber, through business people as opposed to government, where if you get arrested for being homeless, the cop says, I'll either take you to jail or you go to the Haven for Hope. If you go there, you have to give up all drugs, all this stuff. You got to be clean. They give them a place to sleep, something to eat. They give them treatment. You can get, you know, training, job training. You can do everything there, but it forces the person on the beginning end. You got to give up the drugs, no drugs, and, you know, you got to play by the rules.
Oh, so like it's a big rehabilitation center type thing, isn't it?
That's what it is. And it's been, you know, it's not been as successful as they'd like, but it has cleaned up the problem. And I think that kind of model, you have to be, there's always a discussion of whether or not you want to be tough love or soft love. And I think, unfortunately, you got to be tough love. And a lot of our other elected officials don't want to do that. They think that's mean to the homeless people.
Right.
But you got to have rules, you got to draw lines. And I think it's right now, like I say, it's not past the point of no return, but it's probably close to it. But you need law enforcement, mental hospitals, cheaper housing, and rules.
Talking about cheaper housing, that's another huge one. So you're bringing up all my topics. This is awesome. I love it. So cheaper housing, that's it's very easy to say cheap housing, but nothing's cheap, is
nothing
it?
Cheap,
so
no.
And then nothing's cheap if you can't afford it. So what do you think some of the answers for that is? Is me myself, to give you an example of what I'm looking for, maybe is. You look at these cities now and everybody's like building within, which is very expensive. It's in the city. Whereas like if you look at the rest of the world, people sort of live outside of the city and travel in, which is then less expensive because plus there's more land, right?
Yeah.
What are your takes on this type of housing or what's going on right now?
Well, part of it, we've got too much regulation and too many fees. So that's a big part. If you reduce those, I mean, you're going to have to make up taxes some other way, right? But a lot of it's putting on houses, and when people buy a house, they don't think they're paying taxes, but you're paying a whole lot of taxes. The other thing is just sort of natural evolvement. It used to be the population center in Southern California was L.A.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody lived in Orange County. L.A. prices got higher, so people moved to Orange County because it was cheap. Orange County prices are now getting higher, so people are moving to the Inland Empire.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, their prices are starting to go, and people may move out. So a lot of it's just natural progression, but then all the jobs are in L.A. and Orange County, so then you get people driving back and forth. So it's not an easy issue, but part of it is done just by people moving to suburbs, because that's what historically has happened in Southern California. So you're not going to get cheap housing in Orange County or LA because our land values are high, but you can do something with the regulation and just the controls we have on it. And the property taxes are probably okay because we have Prop 13, but every time a new person comes in, that thing bounces up.
Right.
So they're playing a whole lot in taxes. So part of it's just natural, I think. Not everybody is going to be able to live in Southern California. We're going to reach our max, and that's it. To say I want everybody to live here is not practical. When you try to do infill and go up in a city, it's very, very expensive, so it's not cheap. So,
and then that causes other problems, doesn't it? Because
now people
traveling into work, not going to touch on this subject, but then, if we're all going to go electrical, you're not going to be able to get to work because your charge isn't going to make it.
Yeah.
So good luck with that one.
If you saw the news this morning, and they had these people, I don't know, in New York, wherever they're having the storm with their Teslas. Half of them aren't working because Tesla batteries can't work in that cold of weather.
No.
The other half, they finally got to the charging machine, and the charging machine may not work, or you got to wait 2 hours because it takes twice as long to charge it.
Yes, it does.
And a bunch of other people were having their Teslas towed to the charging station. And I said, electric cars may be good someday, but not now. You can get away with a little bit around here. But if you're in areas that are going to get super hot or super cold, electric cars don't work.
No, they don't.
And we're not there yet. We may have an alternate. Well, I'm sure we'll have an alternate fuel sometime. But that's, that's a different issue.
Yeah, no, it totally is. But it's another one of those things that we're facing right now. It's hard.
All the money we're spending for charging stations, all that goes into the price of everything else.
Well, if it was honest talk, it would be almost like, so we're spending all this money on saving the environment, but we can't spend any money and fix homeless.
Right.
Yep. It's almost like, where's it going to, isn't it, really? I saw a thing on, I don't know if it's real or not, but I saw something the other day where people who were having problems charging, they have now mobile chargers come out. So it's somebody in a gas or diesel vehicle.
Generator, right.
It's a gas generator.
And they
charge your car. Yep. And I just thought, start business, why not, right? And so when you became, obviously then you were mayor, was there anything in particular you remember that you feel was a... We'd recognize today in Fullerton as something that you'd changed or was a part of?
Well, the main thing was making it very friendly to business. We had a lot of car dealers. Car dealers are very good for the city because of the sales tax.
Right.
Probably the biggest thing you'd see if you drove around Fullerton is the sports complex at Cal State Fullerton.
Yeah.
We put together a deal to build the football stadium, the baseball stadium, softball stadium, and tennis and the soccer fields in exchange for Cal State Fullerton letting us use their fields. Adult sports and youth sports are very big all over, and they were very big in Fullerton. Fullerton didn't have enough field space, so we needed grass. So we made a deal with Cal State Fullerton, and when they weren't using the fields, we could use them for free.
That's amazing.
City of Fullerton. And that lasted for a long time, but probably building the football stadium, the baseball stadium, and the tennis court, softball stadium was probably the biggest thing if you'd see, because that was a very big project, took a lot of work, cooperation, you know, with the city, with the chamber, with the university, and all the interest groups, because people were all worried about having a football stadium.
Of course, stadium in their backyard. Right, right.
So one thing I did, I formed a citizens group, all the HOAs and the people that lived around Cal State Fullerton. I put them on a committee, said, okay, you guys are going to be involved in the design, or where the lights are going to go and all this stuff. And everything worked out pretty well. They dropped football after we built the football stadium, but that's life. But it's still got a lot of use from modern day. Played there for a while. Servite, the soccer teams all play there, and they mm-hmm. still have two men and women's soccer, still very successful there. So this is getting a lot of use, even though we didn't have a football team.
That's amazing. And those are things we do still see today. So those are huge, impactful things within the city. Well, good job, man. That's awesome. Well done. So moving along a little bit, what then inspired you to go for Senate?
I always thought about running for state office or federal office, but my kids are all small. Mm. And while a lot of people ran when their kids were little, I said, I'm going to stay here because I want to make sure the kids get through school. I had a couple opportunities to run for assembly, but I actually thought about flying back and forth to Sacramento every day, which you can do, but it would kill you. I talked to one guy that tried it for a while, and he said, you just can't do it. You can't be active and stuff. So I passed on it. My wife said, well, you may not get another chance. And I said, I don't care. The kids are more important. So I did have another chance because Ross Johnson, who was the assemblyman, decided to run for Senate. So I left an open assembly seat, a special election. So I said, I think I'm going to do it. And again, the same group, my same campaign committee was basically a lot of people from Fullerton Chamber. So we raised the money. We ran in a special election. We got elected. And it was sort of interesting because one of my kids was getting married in Hawaii at the time, and I said, well, you got to go to the wedding. So back then they didn't have iPhones, they had fax machines, so we were faxing stuff back and forth, and I said, well, we can do this, I got a campaign group, they can do it. And I remember they were sending me copies of some of the hit pieces that people were doing. They always do hit pieces in elections, that's part of the drill. And I tried to hide them from my wife and the family because they didn't want to see that stuff. So I did anyway. So ran for assembly, got elected. You asked, why did I decide to do it? I said, it's probably the same reason I went on the city council. I said, it's okay to be an influencer of votes, but it's also nice to be the person that casts the vote. Mm-hmm. So I said, you know, I think I'm going to try and do that. So I did it. Did that for 5 years because I was in mid-election, and then it just happened to coincide with the Senate seat. The senator was termed out, so I ran for the Senate seat. Did that for 8 years. I was 4 years. I was a Senate leader, which is probably the hardest job because you see what happens to all the leadership, the speakers in D.C., all that. When you're the leader, you have to make a lot of people happy, and you can't because everybody has different opinions.
Right.
But that was probably the hardest 4 years of my life, just doing that, because you're also responsible for elections. You had target members, so you had to raise money and, you know, select candidates and get people to run all throughout the state.
Right.
But it was very enjoyable, had a good time. The other thing was nice, when our kids were gone, my wife could come up with me. She came up probably 3 weeks out of four, and we actually had a little house up there for a while. So she could do her work, you know, there. And then we had a lot of friends in Sacramento, and my wife was actually my fundraiser too.
Oh, wow.
And
see, that works out, doesn't it? Working with your spouse. Yeah, that's important.
When I ran before, the first time, I ran at an odd time, and I couldn't get any of the professional fundraisers. So my wife Linda said, well, I'll do it for you, because she had raised money. She had worked in the chamber in Yorba Linda. She'd worked in Assistance League and a bunch of other things, and all you do in those is raise money.
Right.
So she said, I'll do it. So she did it. And she did a good job, which is really good, because all the lobbyists knew her as well as they knew me. So when we went to functions, Linda would always come along, And, you know, she got more attention than I did because she was better looking. But they liked to talk to her as opposed to me. We had a good time, and it was interesting. A lot of the events back then in Sacramento were members only. Nobody brought spouses. And I said, that's sort of goofy. So I said, well, I'm not going to go unless I can bring Linda. So they said, okay. So they changed the rule.
Wow.
And they started allowing spouses, which is good. I mean, most of those events, you don't want to go and leave your spouse at home.
Right.
So we had a lot of good time there. Went on a lot of trips. They had a lot of trade mission type trips. So we went to China, Australia, Europe, all over the place, South America. It was very educational because it was very useful. And Linda, of course, went on all of them. She got to go shopping. I had to go to meetings. But it was a fun time, very enjoyable. And I said, I don't know if I'd want to do it now. It's a little more toxic now.
Right.
You know, people got along there. I got along very well with the Democrat leaders. And there, you know, there was much more cordiality back then.
Mm-hmm.
And people worked together. And I was the leader of the Senate, was probably one of the more liberal guys up there, but we were good buddies. And everybody said, how can you get along with him? And I said, because his word is good, and he'll negotiate with you on a deal, and you know, you try and get things done. So
right.
It was a fun time.
Looking back, because obviously we're always wise after the fact, aren't we?
Yeah.
Looking back, are there things that you think, because it sounds like you shaped quite a lot of different things in your life so far. Is there an area where you think, well, if we were a part of this, this could have happened? Or is there, I suppose, regrets? Is there anything you think of back now that you might have changed differently?
Probably not. The Republicans, we were always in the minority. I got to serve with three governors, with Governor Wilson, Governor Davis, and Governor Schwarzenegger.
Oh, wow.
So that was interesting. You were always in a much better spot if you had a Republican governor, because even if you're in the minority, the Republican governor would help you. So that made you more effective. Now we're probably not going to have a Republican governor for a long time because the Democrats outnumber us. But I think term limits was part of it. I used to think term limits was good, and now I think it's bad because there was a lot of turnover in all the legislature, not the federal legislature,
mm-hmm.
just locally. And you lost a lot of the friendships that you developed. Too many of the people now that are getting elected, especially at state office, I think are too young. They don't have any life experience. A lot of them are former staffers, and they haven't really lived life, so they really don't know what's going on. And they're looking more at their next office as opposed to doing something now.
Right.
The class I came with, both the Republicans and Democrats, all wanted to do something. They wanted to do something legislatively,
mm-hmm.
you know, fix something. They weren't looking for headlines, and now I think too many of the people are looking for a headline, and they want to get their name in the paper, be on TV, as opposed to just making some tough decisions and doing things.
Do you think some of where we find ourselves today is because maybe people are coming up younger in these positions and they don't have some type of experience, or do you feel there's something else sat in there?
I think a lot of it's term limits. People, especially in California, are always looking for their next job.
Okay.
So they don't spend as much time on the current job. When I was in the legislature, we had a few people or other party been there too long, but there's a natural turnover. You know, people generally don't stay in that spot forever. But you had people with real expertise in health or public safety or insurance or whatever. Now somebody's up there for a year or two and they're a chairman of insurance, and they may know nothing about insurance.
Right.
And they're put on appropriations or budget, and they don't have any background in it. And you need to have some on-the-job training, if
right.
you will, to
mm-hmm.
know how to do this stuff, and some background in a particular area. And I think with the younger people, you're not getting that.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing against young people. I think we need young people. But I look at two areas, both judiciary and legislative. You know, I want judges with experience, and I want legislators with experience. So that's going to mean they're going to be a little older.
Yes.
They're not going to be just out of college.
Right.
And we're losing that. The average age of the judges is actually coming down, which I don't think is a good thing. I want somebody that's been up there, has got experience, and
mm-hmm.
knows what's going on. And same way in the legislature, I think you're losing that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a trend to that? Because when I look around locally in Fullerton, let's say, you know, and being in Rotary, you hear a lot of folks telling, well, you know, if only they did this or if only they did that. But they don't really want to deal with the world's new way of media or what have you. Do you feel that's why more people who are younger are more prone to looking for these positions, and then the experienced folks are thinking, well, maybe I don't want to deal with the backlash of it all? Or?
Well, I think social media has not been good, particularly in politics.
Yeah.
You know, people are afraid to do something that may be controversial or maybe not a bad decision, but a tough decision, because they know they're going to get beat up on social media. So, and what they don't realize, very few people make their political decisions on social media, but it gets headlines.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to see it. And I think they're afraid of making a really tough decision. And back when early years of the legislature, people would do stuff. You know, some of it worked out, some of it didn't. But at least they wanted to make a decision. Now they want to, what I see, the big debate in Sacramento now is whether a 12-year-old kid should play Pop Warner football. We have water problems, we've got energy problems, we've got homeless problems, we've got all kinds of problems in California. And they're not dealing with that, but they want to take care of Pop Warner football. So,
and you feel that's just because of the way that media's shone across it more as an entertainment rather than maybe a way of life or state stability in our lives?
I think it is. Plus, it gets headlines. Even without social media, I remember one of our guys had a spanking bill once, which I didn't think was a good idea. We Republicans had control of the assembly for 1 year. And schools were only a problem. And one of our colleagues wanted to come up with a spanking bill. Spanking is outlawed in schools now. And he wanted to return spanking. And I said, that may be good in your household or something. That's probably not a good bill idea because we're really going to get beat up. And we got beat up on a lot, but that was a bad idea. But I think people are afraid to tackle the big issues. And because it takes a lot of work. And it takes working across the aisle to convince other people that this is a good idea, and you have to use a lot of political capital. And it's easier to do something like getting rid of Pop Warner football. So I think part of it's just the mindset, part of it's younger people, part of it's social media. But I think we haven't had the type of leadership like a Reagan or somebody like that who can really bring people together. Politics has tended to get more divisive and people get further apart as opposed to working together, even at local level.
Mm-hmm.
And another part of it, people, the normal run-of-the-mill person is probably not as engaged as they should be. You know, everybody needs to be involved in politics because it impacts everybody's life. And I think you're seeing that. There was an issue in New York where they closed the high school and sent all the kids home and put them on Zoom and put illegal aliens in the school. And even New York, which is very liberal, they went bananas. You know, that's not how we want to run our school system. So until it hits some of them personally, they may not want to get involved in politics. So there's a lot of ramifications, but you know, I was fortunate. I was there at a good time, worked with some good governors, had some good times. I actually did some things, and I'm worried about getting things done now.
What sort of things are you worried about getting things done now?
Just, well, like, what do you want, which level you want, state or federal?
whichever you would like to share with us.
Well, the federal one, I think, is probably the worst. It's more significant. We've got significant foreign affairs issues with potential of war in various places in Israel and Ukraine and the Red Sea. We've got problems with homeless all over the place,
yeah.
And we've got problems with just budget. And I just reading the last time we had a balanced budget in the United States was when Clinton was president and Newt Gingrich was speaker.
Well, that was a while ago.
In the 90s. And since then, we've never had a balanced budget at the federal level, which is a problem. And we've gone trillions and trillions of dollars in debt, which we'll have to pay sometime.
Right.
The state level, they're not facing, you know, water issue, energy issues, homeless issues, you know, housing and all that kind of thing. They spend more time on Pop Warner football.
Now, just out of interest, because, you know, I'm learning a lot about politics, too, being in this type of role that I'm in now, because generally in business, you don't really have to know too much about it. So on behalf of us all who don't know, would you mind sharing the importance of the budget there and how we can't just keep printing money and what it happens to the country and us normal folks.
You can't keep printing money. We saw that during COVID when they printed billions and billions of dollars, and then we have a large inflation rates that people can't afford to buy bread at the store. Even at the state level, our budget, when I was first in the assembly, I think our state budget was $40 billion a year, and that was in 95. And now in 2024, it's going to be $300 billion as a state budget. And most of that goes for welfare. Roughly half of it goes to K-12, and not all that's being spent because our kids aren't learning to read and write and add. And a lot of it goes to welfare. And I agree, we need to have a safety net. But more and more people, we have the highest poverty rate in the entire United States. We've got more homeless people, more of that. And we need to get off of that. One of the good things, I heard Newt Gingrich speak last week at a luncheon, and he reminded me that when Clinton was president, Clinton was a Democrat, but he was also pretty practical. He was reasonable. And one of the biggest things they did was welfare reform, because we were just, and now we're back to where he was before then. You can't spend all that money on welfare. You need to spend money, taking care of the people you've got here, really educating people, having a good business climate. One of the biggest problems in California is just overregulation for businesses. Mm-hmm. As you know, businesses are moving out of state
all the
time. And one of the main reasons is just too much regulation. Mm-hmm. We have the highest taxation rate. We have too much taxes, more than we should. But the regulatory stuff is just out of line, and at the federal level, there's too much regulation. So there are a lot of things that can be done, but a lot of the legislators don't want to tackle that. They want to tackle something easy. And the big issues aren't easy.
And what do you think, what can we do as regular folks to make government officials understand or talk to them about? What sort of things should we be mentioning to see if things can change around or what things can be done?
Well, you do a good job now with having regular regular meetings and forums with your local electeds. I think it's important to meet with the state officials, the federal officials, and the local as often as you can. And I think you have a good program for doing that. And get your individual business people to, go one-on-one, face-to-face with them, so the legislator or their staff can see somebody and see what the real issue is. And that's one of the biggest thing I think the chamber can do. Just keep the relationship going, because they'll meet with you because you're an important chamber, and then have your members out there so they can talk to them too. Tell them what's going on, why it's difficult to stay here. And a lot of them have moved out of state. Not even Orange County has been impacted by that. So I think it's important to have that relationship and that contact between your members and the legislators.
So you mentioned a lot of things there which we all need to take note. And luckily, on the 26th of this month, we actually have a government affairs cocktail evening here at the chamber, which is where a lot of our government officials are going to be at. And we're encouraging our members to be there and talk about these things you were mentioning. But on a positive note, because there's always a positive side to it, what do you see that is a change from when it was when you were on the Senate floor that is more in a good way?
I think ultimately more people are getting engaged. I mean, most people want to run their life, run their business without government. They don't want to have to worry about who's in office. It's only when government starts to overreach or intrude that they get engaged, and sometimes it takes a lot. And I think because of a lot of the educational issues that are coming up now, the school issues, the homeless issues, people are getting engaged because it's impacting them. Like I say, the average person shouldn't have to get involved in government. You should be able to do your business, run your life, not worry about it. But sometimes when the worries or the challenges come up, people do get engaged, and I'm seeing a lot more of that. I mean, you saw in that little Iowa caucus where 100,000 people went out and 5-degree weather,
yeah,
so they could express their view for a candidate. So I think people are getting engaged more. And while I like to bash social media, sometimes social media raises some of these issues.
Awareness,
and people says, I want to express my opinion. Mm-hmm. I want to do it. And I think the ability to contact your legislators, like you say, you're in a good position. chamber's responsible outfit. You ask legislators to come, they'll come, and your members can talk to them, mm-hmm. and they should take advantage of that and say what, you know, what they want to say. So I think people are becoming more engaged, which is good. You need, you know, we do live in a democracy, and the people that vote win. So if you want to do something, you need to get more votes on the other side. So the fact that we're getting people out, and even the last two presidential elections, I think both of them set records for total number of votes. The first one with Trump and the second one with Biden, I thought that might fall off, but there are actually more people to come out, and I'm guessing this next election,
they're
probably going to get more,
right.
Which is good.
Yeah.
I mean, people have to get engaged. When our forefathers came up with this idea, and I'm always amazed how smart those guys were.
I know, isn't it crazy that
they drew
when
up
you
a
read
constitution
it?
From nothing. I mean, they had a good base from England, but to do what they did was amazing. And they basically said, you know, the people are going to decide, and they wanted a stronger state government than a federal government because they wanted local control,
yeah.
which gets back to a chamber. So it all starts locally, and they want people to get engaged and express their opinion. So I think that's a positive thing that we're now doing what our founding fathers said we should do more of.
How much of that do you think plays a part still in today's political arena?
I think a lot, because a lot of the big debates now at the Supreme Court level are whether or not we should interpret the Constitution as it was written or whether we should modify it to bring it up to, quote, current standards, whatever we are. And for the most part, the Supreme Court has said, no, we think the Founding Fathers had a good idea and we're going to stick with it, which I think is good. You can't have a document that changes every generation.
Right.
You want to have your basic documents have some level of relevance continuously, and it has, but it gets back to the work those folks put into it, putting it together and putting the banking system and all this stuff. It was really amazing. It's like starting a new world from scratch, and they did it, and they did a pretty good job, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think so too. I really do. So moving out on now, because we've touched a lot on politics, and so what happens when you sort of retire as a senator? I mean, what happens to your world then? I mean, it's been your whole world, and then suddenly it closes. What happens?
Well, it did shut it. Your phone. Frequency drops down a lot because when you're in the legislature, especially the leader, you were on call 24/7.
Right.
You didn't control your life. The governor or the legislature could say, okay, we need you back here tomorrow or today. Mm-hmm. So after you get out of that, your life sort of gets back to normal. Like when I was practicing law, you control your schedule. Then I got involved in government relations. I worked for a couple of law firms as basically not really a lobbyist, but just advising them how to get through government wickets and advise clients, public and private clients, how to deal with government at various levels. And it helps if you've been in it, in talking to people, telling people how to get through it. So I'm still doing this. I'm probably working about half time now, but I still enjoy it. I'm still working on a couple people's campaigns, helping them out.
Oh, wow.
So I still stay involved. Still, now we get to play with the grandkids as opposed to kids.
Right.
Do traveling.
That's great. You just feed them candy and hand them back.
That's right. Much better than having your own kids.
It's easier. So another part of one of the things, you've been on many committees and various boards and directorships. What type of advice or information would you be able to share with, because I have a board, there's plenty of nonprofits that have a board. What type of advice would you give to board members even in business today?
I'd say definitely be engaged. I think being involved in the chamber is very important. I was also in the Rotary Club since the 70s. I think service clubs are very important. And they provide a very big role, both, you know, just locally and on a broader scale, but just getting engaged. I was also involved in other groups and association. I was in the Elks, still am in the Elks Club, still in the Fullerton Yacht Club. I'm the Commodore of the Fullerton Yacht Club, very prestigious club, because we have a lot of water in Fullerton. But just staying engaged. And everybody has their own group. I was active in soccer when my kids were in soccer. So I'll tell you one story that was sort of funny, nothing to do with your question. And when I was there, soccer was very new. I hadn't planned to be a soccer coach. but they didn't have enough coaches, and they had a lot of kids that wanted to play. So I got recruited because one of the parents had to be a coach, so I knew nothing about soccer. So I read two books in the library. I learned about soccer, so I started doing it. And also then you had to ref the games because we didn't have any referees. Now they have paid high school kids to do it, which is very good. So I remember I was reffing one game when I was in the council, and I made some call, and one of the ladies in the audience said, "Well, I hope he doesn't run the city like he refs football or soccer games." And I turned over and I said, "I do." But anyways, like just getting gay. Everybody's got a network through youth sports or churches. We were very active in St. Juliana's church. So just developing various friendships. Just the more people get together and work together, it really solves a lot of problems. Mm-hmm. A lot of people now don't want to listen to somebody else's view. I said, you should listen to everybody's view, whether you agree or not, because sometimes they may have a good idea.
Yeah, stems from something else, yeah.
And I really liked being on the city council more than the state legislature, because you could actually talk to people and you could have debates. They were very, what you see on the TV is really not what happens in the legislature. There's very few heavy-duty debates on stuff. A lot of the stuff is just ramrodded through or party line vote. With the city council, you could actually talk to people because you saw them regularly, and you could have discussions. And most of the decisions when the council were unanimous. You know, even though we had Democrats and Republicans, but most of the stuff, you know, just common sense things. But you have to have a relationship with the people and get to know them. You know, go to church with them, have a beer, go to the picnic, see their kids, and all that. So I think it's very important having those kind of relationships at the local level.
So, Dick, you touched on an amazing amount of points there, and one of them was obviously being part of the community and clubs and things like that. And you mentioned you've been in Rotary since the 70s, I believe you said. So, and you briefly mentioned, which is, I haven't been in Fullerton too long, only a few years, but I've heard lots of things about the yacht club and how you're the commodore of the yacht club. So we'd like to share a little bit about this secret squirrel club that's going around there.
Yeah, it's not too secret. But yeah, the Fullerton Yacht Club, I think I started in the 80s, or I think when Brett was born. My law office is within Hunt Wesson building, and I was good friends with one of the Hunt Wesson guys, and they did a promotion once on the Fullerton Yacht Club. In fact, the logo we have on our little membership thing, I stole from Hunt Wesson. Don't tell them. But they did a little promo just on the Fullerton Yacht Club for some product, but then they dropped it. So we did our birth announcement for Brett from the Fullerton Yacht Club. Was the Commodore and Mrs. Ackerman, and we talked about running lights and enclosed head and all this stuff, and what his beam was and his bow and all that. So then I just started up this club. A number of us had boats, but not most of them. Now we probably have 100, 110 members, and maybe 10 people have boats.
Uh-huh.
And we meet, we have two meetings a year, one a Christmas party, and one in Catalina.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason on the Commodore, because I used to pay for all the booze at all the parties to begin. This has been going on for probably 30 years, so it's easy to win if you buy everybody the booze.
Right.
It was just a bunch of people in Fullerton. Like I say, most of them don't have boats, but they just like to get together and have a good time. We do go to one trip to Catalina where people, you have to have a boat, but you don't have to. You can go on somebody else's boat. And we used to have 10 or 12 boats going over there, and now we have maybe 3 or 4, but we still do it. In fact, I used to go on the Ensenada race from Newport to Ensenada.
Oh, really?
And I went on that once, and there was no wind, so we turned around and went to Catalina.
Right.
And that was the start of the Ensenada Alternative. So the same weekend as the Ensenada race, we go to Catalina.
Right. Yeah. Well, hey, Dick, thank you very much for coming in today. Really appreciate it. Thank you for your time and your service to our community, which is more important. And I've really enjoyed today and learning a lot more about you. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.